Okay, today we are going to hear an interview that I recorded last week with the editors of the book Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. It is the new and perhaps definitive biography of Malcolm X, and it's a book that we're going to be giving away to the first six people who call 505-428-1393 and make a pledge of $50 to KSFR. It is a very big, readable book full of pictures and full of the life of this great revolutionary Malcolm X, who we're going to be talking to. Not the author, because the author actually passed away a couple of days before the publication date, and so we cannot talk to him unless we were to somehow be able to talk across the veil, which even KSFR technology has not yet figured out how to do. 428-1393. Before we get to this conversation about Malcolm X, I'm going to introduce you to Aisha Khan. Aisha Khan is a filmmaker. Her latest film is called Made in Pakistan, and she is here to talk about KSFR. Also, welcome.
And public radio.
And public radio.
And how we all need to donate to it.
Yes.
Well, I'm going to talk about my own personal experience with public radio a year and a half ago, when I was constantly on Mary Charlotte's show, when the floods in Pakistan had hit.
By constantly, I think you mean twice, but anyway.
Well, but you gave us a lot of plugging, I remember. The floods in Pakistan a year and a half ago were probably the most devastating humanitarian disaster that the world has seen. We were completely ignored by Western media and literally blacked out. And to this point, you know, to this day, even when I go on my tours with the films and what have you, people don't realize what a big disaster it was, that 20 million people were affected, a fifth of the country was underwater. And it's shows like this and public radio which supported our fundraising efforts. In fact, I just found out about a couple of days ago, Mercy Corps sent us basically announced that our nonprofit organization, Relief for Pakistan, was the second most effective fundraising drive they've ever had, second to Japan.
And that was partly because not only of public radio, but of KSFR.
Absolutely, KSFR and Santa Fe and Albuquerque and New Mexico.
428-1393, 428-1393. Make a contribution if you think this is important. I mean, I think that it's moments like that when I realized that public radio, it's not just entertainment.
No,
it's actually
it's
about making the world a better place.
Making the world a better place, outreach, talking about things which are being ignored by corporate media. It is vital that we support stations like this.
428-1393 is the number. We're going to go now to this interview with Malcolm X, with the editors of the Malcolm X biography. And while they are talking, while we're talking to them, give a call to 428-1393. And as I said, the first six contributors of $50 or more will get a copy of this book if they want it. We're encouraging people to make what are called sustaining contributions, and that is that when you sign up to make a contribution, instead of signing up for, let's say, a $50 or $100 contribution, you sign up for, let's say, $10 or $15 a month, and that way you become a sustaining member, and it helps the station immeasurably. It also makes it fun for you, because then when the next fund drive happens, you can say, oh yes, I'm already a contributor.
I've already done it.
And you might listen and you might not, but I've done that with a number of stations, and when it comes time for the fund drive, I'm happy because I've already given. Then you can always give a little more if you want. But 428-1393, make that sustaining pledge, make any pledge, and we're going to go now to Malcolm X. We're talking today about the book Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, the new biography of Malcolm X that historian Manning Marable worked on for over 20 years. And Professor Marable, whom we were going to interview on this show, died a few days before the publication of this book last year. So today we're talking to the editors of the book, Wendy Wolf and Kevin Doughton. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much for having us here.
Thank you.
So let's just talk for a moment before we get into the meat and potatoes of the Malcolm X story about the writing of this biography, Manning Marable was able to bring some sources and new information to this book that nobody had ever gotten access to before. Tell us about that.
Sure. The project, as you mentioned, it was in process for over two decades, and it really did take that time. The resources that Manning turned to and unearthed in putting it together include everything from countless freedom of information requests to cultivating people who knew Malcolm, who had not spoken on the record about Malcolm. He convinced Louis Farrakhan, who was Malcolm's protege in the Nation of Islam, to go on record in a long interview. The fruits of that are in the book. It really is just a fantastic triumph of research and synthesis of that research in a very readable way.
The greatest source, of course, is the autobiography of Malcolm X, written by Alex Haley and told to Alex Haley by Malcolm X. And that also, I mean, tells some of the story and was one of the influential books in my life and probably in so many people's lives. But it also has inaccuracies. What are some examples?
Well, I would say that it's not the greatest source, but it's the inspiring document from which the biography springs, because it was Manning's work with the autobiography, teaching it in one of his courses and mapping it out against both the facts that he knew about Malcolm's life and the things that were left out of the autobiography about the later episodes in Malcolm's life that began to tickle Manning's intellectual imagination and saying, where did this book really fit into Malcolm's life, and what can we really make of it? And so this is what began the researching. There are a number of things that are rearranged or exaggerated in the book, but the most important is that Malcolm, when he began writing the autobiography with Alex Haley, wanted to use it as an opportunity to make it a conversion memoir, to say, I was saved by the Nation of Islam, and I was saved from my life of sin, basically, and to show himself to be a very, very bad man. And in fact, he was converted in prison by his brother, who'd already joined the Nation of Islam, but he was in prison as a kind of a petty criminal and a petty thug. He wasn't the major player, master criminal that he liked to imagine, or he thought it was more important to portray himself as in order to make his conversion more dramatic. So you start with a less dramatic juxtaposition, and that's where the book begins. Kevin can talk a little bit about what is left out at the end of the book.
Sure. It's one of the things that's interesting is that Malcolm makes almost no mention of what were some of the most interesting and momentous times for him out of the country. And basically, that is in 1964, after his falling out with the Nation of Islam and after his Hajj. Malcolm spent most of the second half of 1964 out of the country, traveling in the Middle East and Africa. One of the reasons he was there was because he had hit upon or been developing an idea of taking the civil rights question in the United States and turning it into a human rights question. And part of this was to sort of bring the issue before the United Nations and to try to get some countries to pass a resolution about it. And to this end, he traveled throughout the Middle East and Africa for months at the last half of 1964. He met heads of state and was treated as a kind of American diplomat in many countries and was greeted as a hero in most of these places as well. However, Malcolm didn't mention any of this
in the autobiography.
Interesting. He merely said I was out of the country, or he sort of just elides it very quickly. But this is a hugely important time for him, not just in developing his ideas of the connections between African Americans and Africans, but in the development of his ideas about global Islam. Very important time, but really never got the chance to unpack it with Alex Haley, so it's not in the book.
Extraordinary. Let's let's get back to that in a little bit, but let's talk for a moment about some of the major events in Malcolm X's life. He was born Malcolm Little into a family that were the followers of Marcus Garvey, who taught black nationalism, as did Malcolm's father, and they were the targets of racial violence, his family. Tell us a little bit about his parents, his family, and his upbringing.
Well, his parents had met and sort of traveled north, had bounced around to a few different cities working for Garvey. I believe they ended up out in Omaha for a while, and then they sort of found white attitudes there just too
welcoming.
A little too much, and ended up outside of Lansing. Malcolm accompanied his father to speeches as a young boy. His father was charismatic, I think, in a way that we see that Malcolm is charismatic. I think it suggested that the seeds of that come from his father. His mother was supportive, but also mentally unstable, and ended up being hospitalized and institutionalized later in her life. Malcolm himself, though he was an incredibly good student, ultimately acted out in class and never set foot in a classroom after the age of 14. So he had a very mostly poor and difficult upbringing in a lot of ways, but one that family became very important to him, and you can see the threads of that family being important to him throughout his life.
And then his father is killed in a suspicious automobile accident, probably run down, probably because of his political activities and his political persuasions when Malcolm is 12, so he goes to live with his sister.
And the life that Malcolm lived and that his family lived, I mean, having his house burned down with the family in it because they had the audacity to move into a neighborhood where there were white people living there, even having their dog shot because they just didn't want this family to have a dog. I mean, it was a childhood with more than enough violence in it that reading about it, you kind of say, you know, if I were Malcolm, I would have had the same response that he did, namely, I'm not going to turn the other cheek.
Right. I'm not sure we can make a one-to-one correlation between the violence that Malcolm experienced and what people say he espoused, because he didn't actually espouse violence. He simply said violence was coming. What I think the book demonstrates so vividly is that these were very violent times. And these were times in the 50s. This is the reality of urban America and the reality of Black America in the 50s and 60s, that it was a dangerous, frightening, very, very dark time, and with not a lot of hope. And what Malcolm drew out of that was a very pragmatic, somewhat pessimistic attitude towards America and towards the institutional forces in America, which were predominantly white.
Which he felt were arrayed against.
And arrayed against Blacks. And it was certainly true in his own personal experience, and it was true in the experience of the people that he knew and that he grew up with and among whom he traveled.
The book's subtitle is A Life of Reinvention. What was his first reinvention?
Well, his first reinvention was probably as Detroit Red when he moved to Boston.
To live with his sister.
I think he was 16 years old. He was very young. And this is where he fell into, I think, the city life for the first time. And there certainly was some petty crime involved in that. And I think he was a bit of a hustler and certainly imagined himself a bit of a hustler. But it was this sort of zoot-suited, colorful figure who, you know, portrayed himself as a big spender and someone who was living that romantic life of crime in a way. I think that's really his first reinvention. And what's interesting is that when you look at that reinvention, in the way that it fits into sort of the idea of what, for instance, zoot suiters signified at that time in the 40s, and what, you know, all of Malcolm's reinventions are really interesting because they sort of like connect up with these cultural touchstones and moments in the history where you realize that he was an actor but also a player in certain ways.
Kind of cipher for the times.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of Manning and our great goals in the book, was to really write the story of the times as well as the story of Malcolm X. And he touches on these eras in Black cultural history. And, you know, he is involved in jazz, he rides the railroads, he gets a job on the railroads. It was one of the great employments.
He avoids the draft, or
he
fakes being insane to avoid the draft. I mean, there's a lot that's sort of wrapped up in what seems to be like a very sort of simple portrayal or character that he's living.
Yeah, it's a great portrait of Harlem and also of the economic inequality and poverty that was happening in the midst of a tremendous economic boom in the United States.
these were boom times. This was the post-war boom, and it wasn't being experienced by the black population hardly at all. And I think that's one of the things that set Malcolm on fire when he started to step into a role of political activism and to start to speak for the black community.
And we're talking about the book Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by Manning Marable. The phones, I think, are a little slow today. We are asking for your contribution. Call 428-1393 to make a contribution to KSFR and get one of the six copies that we have. I'm not sure how many we have right now, but six copies of this book. And we've got a $2,000 goal for this hour. We didn't quite meet our goal yesterday, but, you know, better to aim high, that's what I say, when we're here with filmmaker Aisha Khan. Now, we were talking in the first part of this show about the work that you did with Relief for Pakistan. You raised a huge amount of money during this flood, this giant humanitarian disaster. Mm-hmm. And you and I talked on this show. And I guess that show got heard.
It got heard. I remember by the time the show aired, I was already in New York City at the Richard Holbrooke event.
That's right, because we'd recorded it
two days before. And literally, I came out of that event, and my phone was ringing, and my inbox was flooding, and my assistant was calling crying because she just heard the show. And I was like, why are you crying? She's like, it was insane. She's like, she just heard it, and like people were emailing her, asking her, like, where can they send money? And it was remarkable. Like, it really got to me, like, how big a reach public radio has.
And the podcast then got heard.
Then the podcast got heard. And, in fact, Pakistanis heard the podcast.
In Pakistan.
And were sharing it on Twitter and, you know, social networks and Facebook and what have you, and saying, listen, see how, you know, Americans are helping us right now in this incredible time. And at the same time, it drove me crazy. And I remember you and I talking about it endlessly, that there was literally a blackout in corporate media.
Yeah. I mean, when we think about the airtime that the tsunami got.
Yes.
And then the complete lack thereof, or almost total lack thereof, that the Pakistani flood got.
Yeah.
It was a really huge contrast that could not be explained in any way except willful
neglect,
almost censorship or neglect.
Absolutely. And this drive, the one that Mercy Corps just sent us the alert that we were the second most successful campaign, we raised $151,000.
And what did you do with that money?
We ended up going to these villages. That was the emergency relief one that we did, the 151,000. Then we ended up focusing on five villages in Pakistan. Went to them, their houses had all completely been devastated. Went to them, said we'll start the housing process, and they turned to us and they said no, they want seed and fertilizer. And so we ended up doing an in-kind donation plus all the donations that we got from, you know, listeners like yours. And our goal was 1,000 acres. We ended up planting, I think, 3,000 and more.
And the following year?
The following year, we went back to
the seeds thing. Came up.
The seeds came up. We had a bumper crop in that area. We went back to them, said, should we build your houses now? And they said, no, you now need to build the dikes and the levees. And that's what we ended up doing. Our second drive with Operation USA ended up building those dikes, rebuilding those dikes. And we were the only area in Sindh, in this particular province in Balochistan, that did not get flooded last year with the second wave of floods.
Now, this huge area did not get flooded because you were able to raise the money to build the dikes by sending out the podcast of the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Yes.
This is so unbelievable.
Yes. And, you know, people, like, didn't donate once. They donated constantly to the effort because they got involved, because they heard me on this show, because the other women of Relief for Pakistan went and made the same kind of, you know, partnerships with other public radio and, like, people who constantly kept us on the air or in the news.
428-1393 is the number. We're telling you stories of public radio, and this is why we are asking you to donate, because a resource like this is not to be dismissed. It is to be supported. and we come on a few times a year and ask for your support. The rest of the time, we have almost no commercial sound of any kind. We have a little bit of underwriting, but it's only a few minutes per hour. And all the rest of the time, we give you good programming. We hope it's good programming. I try to make good programming. And in fact, the Malcolm X interview that you are listening to, and we'll talk about Malcolm in a moment, I had an actually longer interview, which will cover the whole show when I aired in its entirety. But right now we're cutting it a little bit short because we want to ask you to support public radio. But it probably a little bit down the line, we'll air the whole thing. And this is the kind of programming you get, namely 48 to 50 minutes on a particular topic of interest with an author or with a thinker who is doing something that maybe you've never thought of before, or even if you knew something about Malcolm X because you've read his autobiography.
Like me.
Well, we'd all read his autobiography. So many of us have read his autobiography. You read You read the biography. You read this Manning Marable book when it came out.
It is fascinating. And you should really donate so you can get the book for free.
Ladies and gentlemen, 428-1393, 428-1393, make a contribution. The toll-free number is 1-866-907-KSFR. That's 1-866-907, what are the, Maryland, what are the
5737.
5737, thank you. 1-866-507-907. 5737. We're going to go back to Malcolm. We'll be back in a bit. Please make those phones ring like crazy. Even if you don't want a copy of the book, consider making a contribution of any size to KSFR. And we'll be back in a few minutes. So Malcolm ended up in jail. He was into petty crime and not so petty crime. And then in jail, he came across, as you said, the work of Elijah Muhammad through his family, the Nation of Islam. What was the appeal of the man, Elijah Muhammad, and the religion for Malcolm at that time in his life?
It offered Malcolm a couple of things. It offered him a kind of discipline that his life lacked. It was a very rigid lifestyle. It was a very controlled, orderly, ruled lifestyle, and it must have appealed to a kid whose life had been very scattered and very fragmented, but who also was highly intelligent, despite the fact that he left school at 14. He yearned for knowledge and for structure, and that was offered. It also offered him, in the person of Elijah Muhammad, an obvious father figure who he responded to very emotionally, and who responded to him. I mean, they became quite close. He was his great protege. And that delivered to Malcolm something emotional, something very strong.
I would add two other things. I think it reconnected him with the Garveyite roots of his parents. I think this was an organization that was espousing a very pro-black philosophy, a very positive philosophy. And I think that's something that appealed to him, especially having been through, I think he was really knocked around, is the sense that you get from looking at everything that's in this biography and the autobiography by his time as a criminal, by his time in Boston, by his time riding the railroads. I think that there was a degrading element of that for him. And I think that the philosophy of the Nation of Islam was restorative in some way. And I think the other thing is that it was something to connect him with his family. His whole family converted before him. And I think it was a way of him in prison to be connected and stay in touch with them.
Tell us more about the philosophy of the Nation of Islam.
Well, it was a separatist philosophy. It had its roots in Garveyism. It had its own eccentric, I would call it an eccentric ideology.
Cosmology.
Cosmology.
As well.
It starting from the kind of the mystical experiences of
Wallace Farad Muhammad.
Yeah. And so it was a very, very unconventional take on Orthodox Islam, with a different set of books and a different set of rules. I think it would be unrecognizable to someone who only understood African Islam.
Practiced Orthodox Islam.
Yeah.
And over the years, Malcolm fielded many letters, many questions, spent a lot of time as the Nation of Islam moved closer toward Orthodox Islam. This is something that that certainly fascinated Malcolm from the time in 1959, I believe, when he made his first trip to the Middle East.
There was also a kind of economic self-sufficiency in the whole thing. And that was a big part of what people practiced when they joined the Nation of Islam.
that's a huge component of it. First of all, they, you know, drawing on the same Garveyite principles of separatism, it was a philosophy of self-sufficiency that the black community could not count on the white community for anything. They couldn't count on them for money, they couldn't count on them for jobs, they couldn't count on them for schools, and they had to establish a separate, complete life for themselves. At some points, they even discussed literally a separate territory, you know, sort of almost seceding from the Union, as it were. This was something that Malcolm proposed for a very long time. They demanded a great deal from their adherents. They were required to tithe. A lot of people gave a lot of money to the nation. It's not clear where all that money went. Certainly didn't go to Malcolm.
No, they preached values of thrift, clean living. Mm-hmm. The penalties for something as basic as getting caught smoking a cigarette were draconian by any measure. But it was both an economic and a cultural lifestyle that was very focused on the community.
As I was reading it, I couldn't help wondering whether that played into the kind of white separate but equal ideology.
Could you elaborate that just a little bit?
So they're saying, we want to be separate, and white people saying, great, let them be separate, which, of course, separate but equal is a hypocrisy.
Well, that's what led the Nation of Islam into those very difficult entanglements with the American Nazi Party and the Ku Klux Klan, both of which Malcolm was, I don't think, particularly enthusiastic about when they was actually happening, and which he came to regret significantly later in his life.
So what happened when Malcolm X got out of jail? I guess he took the X at a certain point, and he was really transformed. He went from being a kind of womanizing petty criminal to an incredibly disciplined member of this organization.
He went back to Michigan, and he rose in the organization very quickly. And he was, over the course of the next few years, sent to various cities to be involved in Nation of Islam activities there. He founded temples, later called mosques, in some cities. He was responsible for selecting overseers and officers of others. He had a tremendous impact in the decade after he got out of prison in building the Nation of Islam. He was a fabulous recruiter, although the fiery oratory and his personal charm and charisma drew thousands, if not tens of thousands of people to the Nation of Islam. It is under the sort of larger figure of Elijah Muhammad, but also the tireless work of Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam became the organization it did.
He also was so hard line that if somebody in his family, for example, his brother, strayed from the discipline of the Nation of Islam, he had no sympathy for them whatsoever.
That's true.
Yeah. I think the situation with his brother, was it Reginald? I think it's Reginald, the one who...
Yeah.
Who that's such a strange incident in Malcolm's life, and it's something that I know Manning and I talked about a lot. We were working on the book, the choice he had to make between the Nation and between Reginald, especially because family was at the heart of the Nation of Islam for him in a lot of ways to begin with. There is something that is hard to hold in the mind in some ways about it.
You're listening to KSFR 428-1393 is the number for the pledge drive. We're talking about Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, and we'd love to hear those phones ring. Aisha Khan is with us, filmmaker, and you've just been on tour.
Yes.
Talking about your films.
Yes.
And public radio played a role in that tour as well.
Yeah, I only did about 45 lectures in 3.5 weeks. And this is a testament to how much I support public radio, that I'm actually here up awake talking about this.
Because you need a vacation from your tour.
Because I need a complete overhaul for my body. But I actually ended up doing an NPR interview, which will be coming out, I think, in April in Oswego, SUNY Oswego. And we were talking about this, you know, the Western narrative on Pakistan. That was one of the questions that came up at the NPR interview. And I made a real strong case for the fact that the only objective narrative on Pakistan is either on public radio or PBS.
Very interesting.
And why we need to, we individuals, everybody listening to me right now, listening to Mary Charlotte right now, needs to support public radio, especially in an election year. I think it is imperative.
428-1393, 428-1393 is the number. It's called listener-supported radio.
Yes.
For a reason.
Exactly.
So when you say objective, it's very interesting because obviously everybody has a perspective, everybody has a point of view, and yet there are facts.
There are facts. And I find that every time I turn on, I don't want to mention them by name, but let's call them corporate media.
Yes.
There is a very defined narrative that they have agreed upon. Whether it's Pakistan, whether it's the elections, any topic going on right now in, you know, mainstream media. And it's bizarre. It's all about selling. It's like it's turned into entertainment.
Yeah.
You know?
It's about selling. It's about ratings. It's also about two other things. One is making your advertisers happy.
Exactly.
Which means staying within a range of narrative. And it also is about maintaining access to the power brokers who you want to have on the air.
Well, you know, let me talk a little bit about my 45 lectures. I've been part of this wonderful program called Caravan Sarai. And people can go Google it and find out more about it. And basically, we've been going to really rural areas, Pakistani artists like myself and other musicians and stuff. And this entire narrative going on about Islamophobia in this country, well, can I just tell you that I did not have any such experience in 45 lectures that I gave in these five communities? In fact, people came, we were sold out. In Plymouth University, we were sold out. They had to change auditoriums. I mean, it was just crazy. We were in New Hampshire where there was no cell phone service. And every single screening, talk, lecture of mine was completely sold out.
So not a lot of Islamophobia.
I'm really beginning to question this. It's not that we're not hearing the news right now in the New York Times. NYPD has been apparently doing surveillance on Muslim students.
Right.
I mean, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you people?
At Ivy League universities.
I know. Like Hi. Yale and Rutgers and what
right.
have you.
Yeah, that's where the real terrorist cells are,
but
no doubt.
But my own very personal experience on the ground with Americans is that they come to my screenings, to my lectures, out of curiosity. And they ask really important questions. And the only thing they're too polite not to bring up is Osama bin Laden. Which I did.
428-1393 is the number. The phones are pretty quiet today. And if you like this show, we ask you to call 428-1393 and make a contribution. And I think that what you're saying is interesting, Aisha Khan, because what happens is we have narratives like the country is very conservative.
Yes.
And then we have the experience of electing a black Democratic
exactly.
president.
Yes.
And somehow, it's like, how do you hold those two concepts in your head at the
exactly.
same time?
Mm-hmm.
And we have to figure this out together. We have to figure out what's actually going on around us by talking to each other, by getting out in the world.
And reaching out through shows like this.
Yeah.
Okay, really getting into dialogue.
Oh, by the way, I want to thank Jill Markstein for making a contribution today. And I also want to thank Anonymous for making a contribution today. A couple of anonymi have called. If you call, you don't need to have your name said on the air. You can make an anonymous contribution, or you can have your name or your dog's name, or mm-hmm. in honor of a relative, you can make your contribution to KSFR. 428-1393, 428-1393. Shall we go back to Malcolm X?
Yes, it's okay. A fascinating interview.
We'll be back in just a bit. So he recruited a lot of people, became extremely active, as you say, a very charismatic, essentially preacher. And while all this was happening, the civil rights movement was also going on, being led in a totally different way by Martin Luther King. And this raises the question of the differences between the two of them and how to fight racial violence. Do you arm and defend yourselves, as Malcolm was saying? Do you use nonviolence? Which is more effective to get things done? That question seems to be perpetually with us. What was Malcolm's position?
I'm not sure how much these two men were circling around the question about what to do about violence. I think they were circling around the question about what to do about the survival of the black community. Malcolm comes from a much more urban environment, a much lower, poorer class of people. King works mostly in rural areas, I mean, with not the rich, but he also works with the middle class. And Malcolm, as I said earlier, has a much more realistic approach towards the economic hazards facing black Americans and the great chasm between black Americans and white Americans, and not putting any faith in the white community to reach over that chasm and help the black community along. He says, you can't trust them, you can't count on them, they're not going to come through for you, you have to come through for yourself. So I don't think that it's about their relationship to violence, though indeed
They had different answers to those questions.
Malcolm was very dismissive of nonviolence as an ineffective tool in this pursuit.
I think at the end of the day, Malcolm just was principally opposed to nonviolence. He thought it was sort of demeaning. And when he saw, you know, people with hoses turned on them or being attacked by dogs, he felt like the only natural thing to do was to fight back and to defend yourself. And on top of that, I don't think that he believed that King's tactics could really chip away or make a dent at the just deeply sown economic problems that Malcolm was seeing in the cities. And this was, you know, poverty born not just from social problems, but from endemic problems with the system, problems related to government mortgages, problems related to all of these sort of big issues that are spinning out in America at this time, whether it's things like the GI Bill or these sort of ways in which the system is creating economic losers.
Where mortgages, redlining neighborhoods so the black families can't get mortgages.
Yeah.
The whole fight over schools.
I've been listening to a whole bunch of his speeches online, and I find myself in this funny position of thinking, here I am a middle-class person, and yet I agree with what he says, because, I mean,
he's completely electrifying.
Well,
and that's what people found over and over again when they listened to Malcolm, when they met Malcolm. I mean, you know, young, white, college-age students who you would consider the enemy in Malcolm's eyes were totally drawn to him and said, you know, they were mesmerized by him. And he, in turn, once the microphone was turned off, was kind and generous and reached out to them as well. I mean, everybody who sat down and had a lunch with Malcolm or who met him, you know, who took him around, who interviewed him, came away entranced by him. He gave new meaning to the word charisma.
How did you find yourself agreeing with him, Mary Charlotte?
Well, I mean, much as you say that this was more about economics than about violence, the sense that the economic system is kept in place by violence, whether that be police violence or Klan violence or whatever, is, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think that one responds not only to his charisma, but to that truth. And this idea, I mean, I was thinking, because I love Dr. Martin Luther King, we played, the week of his birthday, we played nothing but Martin Luther King speeches on this show. So hours and hours of Martin Luther King. And I'm listening then to the Malcolm X speeches, which I think I'm going to probably devote some time to playing on this radio program as well, and thinking that in a way, I mean, Dr. King, theologian, is appealing to something that is inside of all of us, which is our spiritual nature, and rising above the kinds of attacks on oneself and one's family and one's community that is basically the story of black America from the very beginning. And I was thinking Malcolm X appeals to something different, which is, and I don't say this in a negative sense at all, but it's our animal nature. It's the reality of our lives, food, territory, survival, sex. These are the arenas in which oppression is played out. And that's true. And when he talks about that, one viscerally understands what he's saying.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. I spent, I would have the speeches on almost as, you know, I listened to a ton of them while we were working on the book, but then I would also just put them on as background to just absorb them almost in a different kind of way than, you know, than sort of listening to them for their content. And I think that, you know, like you could say of almost any artist, the form and the content sort of fit with Malcolm, right? There's a, even his way of speaking, the poetry of Malcolm is different than the poetry of King, and it's something that Manning points out in the book, and he makes a very good comparison of their cadences and the way that they talk. And Malcolm has this sort of tumbling street cadence that does, I think, in some ways get at the essence of some of these issues in a way that they can't help but sort of strike you. I mean, he brings you to his side.
And it's also linked to a kind of both a deep intellect and a ruthless logic.
Absolutely.
A ruthless logic about the reality of life.
He traveled, he notoriously would fill a blackboard while he was giving a speech with just diagrams and notes for you to sort of follow along with. He was a dedicated teacher.
How did the followers of Martin Luther King react to Malcolm X and vice versa?
Something would tell me that, a couple things. I feel like we took a call, a different interview from a follower of Martin Luther King who didn't seem to have forgiven Malcolm X for his attitude towards King supporters in the last 50 years.
Judging from the phone call we got this morning, I would say not well.
Yeah, judging from that, that's one thing. On the other hand, groups that started out fairly closely affiliated with Martin Luther King, like SNCC, I guess, a Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Over the years, these groups grew much closer to Malcolm. You know, by now you have Stokely Carmichael, other people involved in SNCC. They move toward Malcolm, and you start to see the beginnings of Black Power. So it's different. I think different followers of Dr. King responded to Malcolm in different ways. I think those who sort of hewed to the sort of that nonviolent approach, that figure, I think they still in some ways maybe see him as misguided. But then I think other people also, especially as the times progressed and the times changed and Vietnam became an issue and everything became more heated, I think other people started to see a little more of what he was talking about.
And they saw Malcolm's prescience for what it was.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the things that people can respond to today, because so many of the problems that Malcolm outlined in 1961 are problems that we still face in 2012.
Exactly. Malcolm X became a target of police and FBI surveillance. Describe this surveillance and why they were doing it. What was the threat that they believed he posed?
Well, I mean, when you look at the list of people that J. Edgar Hoover was spying on in the 1960s, it doesn't seem like it took particularly much to get on their bad side.
I mean, the New York City Police Department threat to public stability.
Exactly.
You know?
They thought
he was a rabble rouser and was going to cause public riots and burn the houses down.
There's a great quote in the book. An early memo that they wrote about Malcolm X, the FBI wrote about Malcolm X, where they're like, we can't really get anything on this guy. He's really smart, he's really careful, and we need to figure out a way to control him.
And fascinatingly, one of Manning's great sources was the guy at the New York City Police Department who was basically in charge of tapping Malcolm.
Who was listening to him
the whole time, and through the process of listening to him, becomes converted. It says, you know, wait a minute, this guy actually makes a lot of sense. You know, he's not who we think he is. He's someone else. He may be dangerous, but he makes a lot of sense. And I have to say that being tapped by the FBI is a horrible moral crime and an insult, but it's an incredible boon to archivists and historians because we are able to listen in on Malcolm's conversations.
So you had access to all of that?
Manning finally did, after many, many dogged years of freedom of information.
Some of the stuff, it really was a trickle-out kind of thing. I know there have been little things published over the years of some of Malcolm's files, but, I mean, more the NYPD files, which were, I think, languishing away in a box somewhere. I mean, the amount of things that had been hidden, kept away, forgotten that Manning unearthed this book, it's a remarkable amount of material.
So why did Malcolm X break from Elijah Muhammad?
Oof, it's a complicated question, and I guess it has two two main answers. I think the first is political, and it has to do with the fact that Malcolm came to believe that separatism wasn't an effective answer to the problems of black people anymore. I think that he came to see that there was a kind of implausibility to it, and that action was needed, and the kind of action that could redress these problems was action that had to happen within the system. And the Nation of Islam had a very apolitical stance. They didn't want anyone involved in politics. They told their people not to get involved in politics, not to vote, all of these things. And Malcolm just came to think that this was not the way to effect change. It was not the way to improve communities. And so that was something that was trailing along with him and sort of building up steam. The second is a more personal level. I think we talked about earlier, you know, Elijah Muhammad was like a father figure to Malcolm. And when Malcolm became aware that Elijah Muhammad had been having affairs with many of his young secretaries, including one young woman whom Malcolm had almost married as a younger man and who he obviously had had special feelings for, there was a tremendous sense of betrayal for him over this. And I think these two things, the political and the personal, are sort of intertwined in causing that break.
Well, not only did he have affairs with them, but he got them pregnant and then abandoned them.
Yes. Hardly,
put it all out there.
Hardly the great apostle of the, yeah, of the discipline and family values that he was espousing for the rest of the nation. Obviously, the nation also wanted to get rid of Malcolm.
Yeah.
They thought he was a threat. They thought
he
was too big, he was too popular, he was going to eclipse Elijah Muhammad. They were just as happy to see him disappear. And as we talk about the assassination, we talk about a convergence of interest, a convergence between the nation, the New York Police Department, and the FBI, all contributing directly or indirectly their own pieces to creating the circumstances in which Malcolm is gunned down.
And you're listening to KSFR, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, during the KSFR Fund Drive. 428-1393. Let's get a little flurry of calls right now to KSFR and get our numbers up. The phones have been a little bit slow this morning. 428-1393, 428-1393. And calling on all revolutionaries and their supporters. Aisha Khan is with us also, filmmaker from Pakistan. And
I'm listening to this interview that you've done about this book, and it is so fascinating, you know, the many lives of Malcolm X.
I know.
And I always wonder, like, he had come to a point in his life where he was turning into this completely spiritual human being. And what he would have been.
I know. I think about that with Martin Luther King,
yeah,
and Malcolm X both.
Yes.
The wisdom that they could have brought to us because,
right,
of all their activities and everything they did and saw. I mean, when you're a leader up front like,
mm-hmm,
that, you see things that the rest of us don't see.
Exactly.
You know things the rest of us don't know.
Yeah.
And for that to be cut short, they were both just shy of 40 years old when they were killed.
Is that true?
They, yep, just, they both lived to... Malcolm X was born in 1925 and died in 1965,
oh,
was shot by an assassin,
right,
and from the Nation of Islam. And Martin Luther King was born in 1929 and died in 1968.
So young.
Also 39 years old.
What a loss to humanity, I swear.
It really is. 428-1393 is the number. Let's get the phones ringing. You can get a copy of the book. We've got six copies of the Malcolm X book. I don't know how many of them are gone yet, but I'm thinking there's still a couple left.
And I'm going to give a shout out to Pakistani Americans and Pakistanis who are going to get this via email, the podcast, that they need to support public radio in the U.S., especially for the image of their own country.
That's right. I think that's very important. I don't know how many Pakistani Americans are listening, but if you are listening, give a call right now, 428-1393, the 505 area code, 505-428-1393. And if you are just American-American,
yes,
or any German-American, Italian-American,
Greek-American, you need to support public radio.
Brazilian-American. Give a call. We have a Brazilian sitting at the next table. 428-1393 is the number, because we try, and I could, you know, a friend of mine once, many years ago, was involved in a group that got together once a month, and they called themselves the Country Club, and they each Sunday, in that once a month, they picked a country, and everybody in the group was responsible for doing research on a different aspect of that country. So one person was responsible for the food, and they would make some food of that country. And one person would talk about politics and history and education and environment and landscape, and somebody would bring pictures. And that was the country club. I loved it. And I thought, I wonder if we could do that in radio, do a show called The Country Club.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
It'd be fascinating.
Yeah, but, I mean, we live in one of nearly 200 countries on the planet Earth, mm-hmm. and we try to give airtime to not
everybody.
Only this nation, but the rest of the world as well. 428-1393. The phones are now ringing, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
I love it. And let's sell out all six copies of this book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention by Manning Marable. I actually had gotten a note from the publicist of this book. The mm-hmm. publisher is Penguin, and I guess I'm on their mailing list. They mm-hmm. they send out to every station in the country, and they said, do you want to do an interview with Dr. Manning Marable? I said, absolutely.
Oh.
We were scheduling it,
right.
and then a few days before the publication date, she wrote and said, he's not feeling well, we have to postpone. And then 2 days later, she wrote, Dr. Marable passed away.
I mean, it was such a shock, because it's such a definitive work on Malcolm X.
It is, and it would have been so wonderful to be able to talk to him.
Yes.
And I think it's also strangely parallel that Malcolm X died right before the publication of the autobiography
That's
of Malcolm
right.
X.
That's right, which I have also read, which most Pakistani kids have read.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, that's so interesting. 428-1393 is the number. We've just got about a minute and a half left before we go. And that's another thing. Sometimes I wonder if the rest of the world knows us better than we know the rest of the world.
Yes.
Like,
well, I'll constantly make this, case to the American audiences that I go and lecture at, that the rest of the world is so Americanized, you have no idea.
Yeah.
Like, I think Pakistanis took a day off when Michael Jackson died.
Oh, good.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, thank you for calling at the end of this program, and we've just got 30 seconds left. 428-1393. Aisha Khan is a filmmaker, and if anybody hasn't seen her film, Made in Pakistan, maybe they can rent it. Is it on Netflix?
No.
Is it in the video library
no.
here in San Jose?
They have to invite me
okay.
as a speaker for both films.
Well, if you want to do that.
But you can find us on Facebook and Twitter,
all
Indus
right.
Valley on Twitter.
Thank you so much for being with us. 428-1393. Time to go. Ciao.